Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
I think that there is a real question of what is private and intimate and what is public and political, but I also think that there is a tremendous crossover. And what did that have to do with what went on in the lover's bed, right, in the bedroom, mm-hmm, in the innermost sanctum of the heart?
One of the things that I've tried to do in my own work has been, so far, has been to work with historical events and make them intimate.
Two American poets, readings and discussion this week on Soundings. My guests are Rita Dove and Adrienne Rich. Rita Dove's collection of poems, Thomas and Beulah, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1987. Adrienne Rich's most recent collection of poems, Time's Power, was published last spring by W.W. Norton. We begin with readings by Adrienne Rich and Rita Dove. First, Adrienne Rich.
This is a poem that I wrote thinking of a friend who is a poet, with whom for a number of years I raised my children side by side. We lived in adjacent apartments in New York. Poetry 3. Even if we knew the children were all asleep and healthy, the ledgers balanced, the water running clear in the pipes, and all the prisoners free, even if every word we wrote by then were honest, the sheer heft of our living behind it, not these sometimes lax, indolent lines, these litanies. Even if we were told, not just by friends, that this was honest work, even if each of us didn't wear a brass locket with a picture of a strangled woman, a girl child sewn through the crotch, even if someone had told us, young, this is not a key, nor a peacock feather, not a kite, nor a telephone. This is the kitchen sink, the grinding stone. Would we give ourselves more calmly over, feel less criminal joy, when the thing comes, as it does come, clarifying grammar and the fixed and mutable stars?
Adrienne Rich, reading from Your Native Land, Your Life. With a reading from her poetry, here now is Rita Dove.
This is a poem that is going to appear in my next book. It's about my daughter, but it actually is about children coming into their own what kind of myths we ascribe to them. And it's called The Breathing, The Endless News. Every god is lonely, an exile composed of parts, elk horn, cloven hoof. Receptacle for wishes, each god is empty without us, penitent, raking our yards into windblown piles. Children know this. They are the trailings of gods. Their eyes hold nothing at birth, then fill slowly with the myth of ourselves. Not so the dolls. Out for the count, each toe pouting from the slumped over toddler clothes, no blossoming there. So we give our children dolls, and they know just what to do. Line them up and shoot them. With every execution, doll and God grow stronger.
Rita Dove, reading from Grace Notes, published this month by W.W. Norton. Now in a discussion about their poetry, here are Rita Dove and Adrienne Rich.
Rita, one of the things that I've felt very a great deal of empathy with in your poetry is this use of history as personal life, as memory, as in some of your early poems, in The Yellow House on the Corner, where you speak in the persona of the Afro-American slave, the slave who is escaping, or the Afro-American after emancipation. And I feel as though that use of history as personal memory is something that's very, very crucial throughout your work and goes down to, you know, Thomas and Beulah, which is the latest work of yours I've seen. And that it also has something to do with a real sense of family. And I didn't know whether Thomas and Beulah were actual family or a kind of fictionalization of relatives. I was kind of interested in that, and I was also kind of interested in the way in which you return in your first book to the pre-emancipation past, and then it seems like you're moving, you know, further into more recent history.
Well, Thomas and Beulah were based upon my maternal grandparents, and but it is a fictionalized account of their lives because they were both dead by the time I wrote the book. And I think you're absolutely right. I felt that from the poems on slavery in The Yellow House in the Corner, I've been somehow taking a big circle and then coming back home, and that way trying to find my way back to the very intimate and personal. But family is important, and it's something for me, and it is something that I think for many, certainly for Afro-Americans, a rock. Regardless whether you reject the family and go off, it's still there and they claim you.
Well, it's very similar for Jews.
What about motherhood? This is implicit in a lot of what you're saying here.
Well, that's where it all begins in a certain way. I mean, that's the point, the intimacy between mother and child, and then to extrapolate on that, the family. That's where all of our connections begin and all of our learning what is self and what is other and how do they connect and our responsibilities toward the other and how that enriches ourselves. That's really where it all begins. And I think that, well, you know, with motherhood, when it happens, nothing in our society prepares us for what it is like. Nothing.
Nothing.
And I think in some other societies it does, but it's a peculiar American kind of distancing from the real intimacy of motherhood that's been kind of taken from us, that I find such a revelation. Of course, I'm a young mother now, so.
Well, I'm the mother of three grown men in their early 30s. I guess I feel, as I did when I wrote A Woman Born 10 or more years ago, that one of the peculiarities of any society in the contemporary westernized world is that it gives this awesome responsibility to women as mothers without a great deal of power. And that, and often with almost no power at all in the real world, where beyond the intimate mother-child bonding, where public policies are made, where decisions are made, where the terms on which we live are created.
You take me back to this idea, this notion of the insider and the outsider at the same time. I just finished reading the novelist that Rita Dove will be familiar with. He has a wonderful line. He says, "The more that your past expands, the more your future shrinks." You think that's true? Is that what you had in mind, Adrienne, when you talked about being a poet, being Jewish, being a woman, being a mother? Am I loading the question?
Well, when you say the more your past expands, the more your future shrinks.
I didn't say that.
Well, you quoted it. I don't know who said it.
That happens to be Fred Vibon, who is Rita's spouse in a novel called The Stain.
What about that? Well, I mean, I think in kind of chronological terms, I'm about to be 60 years old, and I'm realizing that it's one thing to say the next 20 years when you're 30 and another thing to say it when you're 60. Mm. My youngest son is just today 30, so I've been thinking about that. Mm. And yes, in one sense, there is less time. The expansion of the past is a very fascinating thing to me. The increasing availability of our past as we mature, as we grow older, as we have more power to reflect on it,
yeah.
Seems to me, and in that sense, I guess I don't want to make such a distinction between the past and the mm-hmm. future, because it seems to me that that enriches our sense of the future, potentially.
Adrian, you've written some wonderful poems where that happens within the space of the poem. Thinking of North American Time, which does that very well, and where a flower will suddenly emerge and almost take over a century, right?
Well, when I wrote that poem, I was feeling very acutely the decontextualization of the kind of writing that I am doing and want to do as a woman, as a lesbian, as a feminist, as someone who is questioning always.
Is there, no, wait, we're sort of insistently vague and abstract there. When you say relationship, can I use a word like responsibility?
Well, in a poem in this book, which is coming out in May, called Time's Power, again, you see the theme of time is very much with me. In a poem in this book, I say, poetry isn't revolution, but a way of finding out why it must come.
Hmm.
The things that I feel have to change are the orders of priorities in this society, the valuing and caring about human life and human beings above profit and greed and war,
mm-hmm.
The necessity for freedom and dignity for everybody.
Somebody may be listening to this discussion and say, well, here we have these two poets, speaking of privileged people. Isn't that a little arrogant to talk that way about fixing the world? Or is that what poets do? Rita?
I don't think that Adrian said that that's what poets do. Mm-hmm. The line, would you say it again?
Poetry isn't revolution, but a way of knowing why it must come.
Hmm. Okay. And the difference in that is it's not assuming that poetry is going to change the world, that we as poets are going to write the poem that's suddenly going to fix things, which would be, you know, deluded and quite arrogant. But in being attuned to and vigilant, I think, to what's happening in the world, as every individual has to do. I think this is something it's not a poet's privilege to, you know, to look at the world. Everyone should be doing that. And then as human beings acting upon that. But in being absolutely honest with oneself and in daring to look in the dark corners of the soul.
I think that one of the things that has happened in Western culture is that the poet is put in this kind of sacrosanct position, and so questions like yours do come up, and they come up often. And there are lots of other cultures in which poets are people and people are poets, and poetry is part of life. And where the poet is not set in this kind of niche to pronounce or to be ignored. And I feel as though the poetry that means the most to me is a poetry that is attempting to speak very largely,
mm-hmm.
Not to simplify, not to go for a popular audience or for popular ideas, but to be out there for a lot of different kinds of people.
Let me put another line on the table here. Rita, I want you to respond to this. This is from Adrienne Rich's Poetry One. Can you remember when we thought the poets taught how to live?
I can remember. It's such a wonderful passage. I'm just smiling here, and that doesn't come across on the radio. But I can remember when I wanted to be a poet, and I was really not writing very much at all at that point, but just dreaming about being a poet. And I think in the late 60s, early 70s, there was this sense of a poet could teach you how to live, and to be a poet was somehow to be a better human being, which I've luckily grown out of, you know. But it's... when poetry also gets connected, or any kind of thing gets connected with movements, there is always that temptation to make a person or an enterprise larger than life, that Black poetry is going to change the world, that feminist poetry is going to change the world, and in fact, it's people who do it. It for me as a poet, and as I said, I grew up on the cusp, the backside of a cusp of great energy and political energy in this country from the 60s. And as I was coming of age, I watched the marketplace kind of squelch all of these wonderful ideals.
Right.
And I guess without having to live through it, saw that, you know, nothing saves you but yourself and people working together. And, you know.
Let me ask you to comment on this, Adrienne Rich, Rita Dove. Which comes first, the social engagement, the political passion, the aesthetic charm?
Well, what you're calling the aesthetic part is for me very tied up with the passion. Coming into language, coming into music, which was for me a very early experience because my mother is a musician. Having poetry read aloud, beginning to make my own poems in my head and then to say them and then to write them was a kind of coming into empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time that as I grew older and continued writing poems, I felt disempowered in a lot of other ways. And I think that the struggle to, in your own life, understand empowerment and disempowerment, in your circumstances, whatever they may be, and to unite that with that early passion for language, for music, for rhythm, for sound, for images, is what happens. At least that has been my experience of it.
Rita, how did this happen with you? How does it happen for you now?
For me now, the two, passion and the aesthetic charm, as you put it, are so tied up that I have no idea anymore when I sit down what comes first. I couldn't answer that question. I don't think anything ever comes first. If it's going to work, it's going to come all mixed up together. There are certainly moments in the writing of something where one will help the other out when the aesthetic considerations are kind of, I'll bring them to the fore because I need to be helped over a spot and maybe that will help me get there. And other times when the passion will get me past some technical quirk, but they're so wrapped up now that I couldn't tell the difference. Mm. I think when I first began writing, when I was very, very young, I wrote much more for the charm of the language because I knew nothing. And also, you know, and also because I was terrified of the world, and I could go off on the language and maybe I end up someplace I never would have dared to go to otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rita, I've been wondering about something that your poems have brought up for me. For Jews, the use of the Holocaust as a metaphor is a very questionable practice. it is the whole question of the way in which language can banalize and trivialize an overwhelming experience. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, reading some of your historical and persona poems, about whether you feel that slavery also, as metaphor, cannot work. Whether, and I think about trivializing of words like slave and slavery in common parlance when someone says, well, you know, I've got a slave in the office to do my mm-hmm. Xeroxing or something. And I've always found that very, very offensive. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, in terms of poetry, how you feel about that.
Well, it is a real dilemma when an experience is so overwhelming, such as slavery or the Holocaust, that language is not equal to it in any way. And also the additional sense of people reacting to it by shutting it off because it is so immense. And I feel that it should be insisted upon. I mean, I feel that if we don't go up to that edge and risk, well, trying to get beyond the sense of it being trivialized, that it gets lost. Memory is very short. People's memories are very short. Countries' memories are very short. Mm-hmm. And that, as dangerous as it is to try to use that as a metaphor, in a way we have to keep trying to remember. We can't let people forget. We can't mm-hmm. let ourselves forget.
What about the other end of that spectrum or polarity, Rita Dove, Adrienne Rich? If you have on the one hand the enormities of history to deal with as poets, what about the rather more, you've used the word trivial here a couple of times.
Well, I think that the answer to that, you know, could be the complete works of Emily Dickinson, who, you know, made right. enormous poems of very brief length out of those small moments. Yet those small moments are very often the immense moments of our mm-hmm. lives. What I would say that what we have been taught to think of as major experience mm-hmm. in the canon, in that white male canon, is not necessarily what has been major experience for other people, for women, mm-hmm. for people of color.
Right.
So that dichotomy doesn't work.
How about this, Rita?
Well, you know, I was thinking from Adrienne's question, to how interesting it is that you have been recently in poems confronting or dealing with the question of the Holocaust and your relation as a Jew to it. And I'm thinking of the wonderful poem Yom Kippur, 1984, where in fact what the question you're asking, small things, large things, how do they fit together, is answered many times over in the poem, because there are all these juxtapositions of the poet alone in solitude on the West Coast, and then juxtaposed with Robinson Jeffers, juxtaposed with these mm. nameless women who are being, you know, who can't walk alone at night, you know, that kind of terror that goes along, and very small moments, which then become large and precious too. I think that, as you say, every moment is large.
I think that the same thing is important to me that's been important for a long time, which is, what does it mean to be a poet in this country, to be an American poet at this point in history? And what does it mean to, as Wallace Stevens says, ourselves in poetry must take our place, mm-hmm. The men of the time and the women of the time, what does it mean to do that? What does it mean to be a person with what has been named verbal privilege, mm-hmm. to be listened to be read, to be published, in a culture where there is increasing illiteracy, increasing maleducation, and what does it mean to be a political person who is a poet and a woman?
How about this, Rita Dove?
For me, I think that at this point, I am very concerned with what it means to be a human being in this century, and then given, as Adrienne has said, verbal privilege, what does one do with it? And in that sense, I mean, I really have I find myself still a learner, and I feel like I'm just mm-hmm. beginning, and that the poems I really want to write are ahead of me. But and I also feel that everything that one does is a political act, and that every poem that I write is a political act. Now the question becomes, how do I open myself in that moment of extreme intimacy to allow all the possibilities in?
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion featuring Rita Dove and Adrienne Rich. During a recent fellowship year at the center, Rita Dove worked on a sequence of poems entitled Durer's Beauty. Adrienne Rich's most recent collection of poems, Time's Power, was published last spring by W.W. Norton. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 466. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, the topic will be criminality and human nature. Listen for James Q. Wilson of the University of California at Los Angeles. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week marks the anniversary of Calendar Adjustment Day, which occurred in Great Britain during the first week in September 1752. The Gregorian Correction, as it was nicknamed, eliminated 11 days from the calendar, and there was rioting by citizens who demanded the time back. In early September of the year 490 BC, the outnumbered Athenian army met and defeated the invading forces of Persia in the Battle of Marathon. In another military action, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain announced a declaration of war against Germany in early September 1939. Finally, birthdays during the first week in September include Walter Reuther, the American labor leader, Lydia Sigourney, the American author of more than 65 books on morality and religion, Jane Addams, the founder of Hull House in Chicago, and Buddy Holly, the American rock and roll musician. Walter Reuther was born during the first week in September 1907, Lydia Sigourney in 1791, Jane Addams in 1860, and Buddy Holly in early September 1936. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Two American poets, this week on Soundings. Rita Dove won the Pulitzer Prize in 1987. Her most recent collection is Grace Notes, from which she reads this week on Soundings. Adrienne Rich's collection, Time's Power, appeared last spring. Empowerment, intimacy, motherhood, and the poetic responsibility. Rita Dove and Adrienne Rich, this week on Soundings.